MGM presents The Picture of Dorian Gray. Starring George Sanders, Herb Hatfield, Donna Reed, Angela Lansbury, Peter Lawford, Lowell Gilmore, and Richard Fraser. Produced by Pandro S. Berman. Screenplay Albert Lewin. Based on the novel by Oscar Wilde. Musical score Herbert Stothart. Director of photography Harry Stradling. Paintings of Dorian Gray, Ivan Le Lorraine Albright. Paintings of Dorian Gray as a young man, Enrique Medina. Recording director, Douglas Shearer. Art direction, Cedric Gibbons, Hans Peters. Set directions, Edwin B. Willis. Costume supervision, Irene. Men's costumes, Vallis. Makeup created by Jack Dawn. Film editor, Ferris Webster. Directed by Albert Lewin. A quote from the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam. I sent my soul through the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell. And by my soul returned to me and answered, I myself am heaven and hell. London, 1886. A hansom cab rolls slowly past elegant townhouses on a bright summer morning. In the cab, a dapper gentleman puffs on a cigarette while reading.
Lord Henry Wotton had set himself early in life to the serious study of the great aristocratic art of doing absolutely nothing. He lived only for pleasure, but his greatest pleasure was to observe the emotions of his friends while experiencing none of his own. He diverted himself by exercising a subtle influence on the lives of others.
The hansom stops.
18, I think you said, sir. Shall I wait, sir?
Yes.
Lord Henry heads for the front door.
Among Lord Henry's friends was the painter, Basil Hallward. He had been strangely secretive about his latest painting, and Lord Henry, sensing a mystery, determined to discover what it was that his friend wished to conceal.
I'm sorry, my lord, Mr. Hallward is not at home. Mr. Hallward doesn't wish to be disturbed.
Lord Henry brushes past the butler and on into Basil Hallward's studio. Basil glances up, then continues with his painting. Lord Henry approaches slowly, intrigued by the large canvas.
It's your best work, Basil. The best thing you've ever done. Of course, I can't believe that anyone is really as handsome as that portrait. Who is he? What's his name? Why are you being so secretive about it? It's a great painting. You ought to send it to the Grove now, let everyone admire it.
I shall not send it to anyone.
But why?
I've put too much of myself into it. I knew you'd laugh, but it's true all the same.
Well, there certainly isn't any resemblance between you and this young Adonis. You have an intellectual expression, and intellect destroys the beauty of any face. Don't flatter yourself, Basil. You're not the least like him.
Of course I'm not like him, and I'm glad of it.
The wisdom of Buddha. You always did have a passion for virtue, Basil. Why are you glad you're not like him?
We suffer for what the gods give us, and I'm afraid Dorian Gray will pay for his good looks.
Dorian Gray? Is that his name?
Yes. I didn't intend to tell it to you.
If I'm going to keep on visiting you, I'll have to send you some good sherry. Why didn't you intend to tell me his name?
I can't explain. As I've grown older, I've come to love secrecy. I suppose that sounds foolish to you.
Come into the garden. It doesn't sound foolish to me at all. You forget that I'm married, and that the one charm of marriage is that it makes a life of deception absolutely necessary to both parties.
I believe you were really a very good husband, Harry, but that you were thoroughly ashamed of your own virtues. Your cynicism is simply a pose.
Being natural is simply a pose, and the most irritating pose I know. But you haven't answered my question. I want to know the real reason why you won't exhibit Dorian Gray's picture.
There's really very little to tell, Harry. Besides, I'm afraid you will hardly believe it.
I can believe anything, provided it's quite incredible.
I'm afraid this will seem so. There's something I can't quite understand. Something mystic about it.
Mystic?
I don't know how to explain it, but whenever Dorian poses for me, it seems as if a power outside myself were guiding my hand. It's
as if the painting had a life of its own, independent of me. That's why I'm not going to exhibit it. Belongs rightfully to Dorian Gray, and I shall give it him.
I want to meet this extraordinary young man. I think we should be friends. I always choose my friends for their good looks and my enemies for their good intellects. Man cannot be too careful in his choice of enemies.
Harry, I despise your principles, but I do enjoy the way you express them.
I like persons better than principles, and persons with no principles better than anything else in the world. Now I remember.
Remember what, Harry?
Where I heard the name of Dorian Gray.
Where was it?
Well, don't look so startled. It was my Aunt Agatha's.
My aunt told me that she discovered a wonderful young man who was going to help her with her charities, and that his name was Dorian Gray. I pictured somebody with spectacles and lank hair tramping about on huge feet, and so I avoided meeting him. It's a very common type of butterfly, basil, Limonitis Sibylla, hardly belongs in a gentleman's garden.
I'm glad you didn't meet Dorian Gray.
Why? I don't want you to meet him.
They both look up.
Who's that at your piano, Basil?
Lord Henry strolls over to the door of the studio, followed by Basil. With his back to the door, a young man sits playing at the piano. They enter.
You've come early today, Dorian.
Have I? You must lend me these pieces, Basil. I want to learn them.
That depends on how you sit this afternoon.
But I thought the picture was going to be finished today.
It will be.
Please go on, Miss Gray. You play brilliantly.
This is Lord Henry Wotton, Dorian, an old Oxford friend of mine.
My aunt has spoken to me about you, Mr. Gray. You're one of her favorites. And one of her victims, too. You shouldn't go in for philanthropy.
Harry, I want to finish this picture today. Would you think it rude of me if I asked you to go away?
Am I to go, Mr. Gray?
Stay and tell me why I should not go in for philanthropy.
You don't really mind, do you, Basil? You've often told me you liked your sitters to have someone to chat to.
Sit down then, Harry. And now, Dorian, get up to the platform. And don't pay any attention to what Lord Henry says. He has a bad influence over his friends, with the single exception of myself.
Have you really a bad influence, Lord Henry?
There's no such thing as a good influence, Mr. Gray. All influence is immoral.
Why?
Because the aim of life is self-development. To realize one's nature perfectly. That's what we're here for. A man should live out his life fully and completely. Give form to every feeling, expression to every thought. Reality to every dream. Every impulse that we suppress broods in the mind and poisons us. There's only one way to get rid of a temptation, and that's to yield to it. Resist it, and the soul grows sick with longing for the things it has forbidden to itself. There's nothing that can cure the soul but the senses. Just as there is nothing that can cure the senses but the soul.
Turn your head a little more to the left, Dorian.
The gods have been good to you, Mr. Gray.
Why do you say that?
Because you have the most marvelous youth, and youth is the one thing worth having.
I don't feel that, Lord Henry.
No, you don't feel it now, but someday you will feel it terribly. What the gods give, they quickly take away. Time is jealous of you, Mr. Gray. Don't squander the gold of your days. Live. Let nothing be lost upon you. Be afraid of nothing. There is such a little time that your youth will last, and you can never get it back. As we grow older, our memories are haunted by the exquisite temptations we hadn't the courage to yield to. The world is yours for a season. It would be tragic if you realized too late, as so many others do, that there is only one thing in the world worth having, and that is youth.
Dorian Gray had never heard the praise of folly so eloquently expressed. The creed of pleasure soared into a philosophy of life, while Dorian stood as if he were under a spell. He felt afraid of Lord Henry's ideas and ashamed of himself for being afraid. It was as if he were learning to know himself for the first time, as if a stranger had revealed his own most secret thoughts to him. For the first time, he became conscious of his youth and conscious of the fact that one day he would lose it.
My visit to you hasn't been wasted, Basil. I found a rare and beautiful butterfly, Euvanessa antiopa. It's very unusual in England. Don't you think it's beautiful, Mr. Gray?
Yes, Lord Henry, very beautiful.
You may sit down now, Dorian. I'm glad you met Lord Henry after all.
Are you glad, Mr. Gray?
I'm glad now. I wonder if I shall always be glad.
Always? That's a dreadful word. Makes me shudder to hear it. Women are so fond of using it, they spoil every romance by trying to make it last forever. The only difference between a caprice and a lifelong passion is that the caprice lasts a little longer. Oh, but I believe our hostess has appeared.
A little girl in ringlets hurries across the room to greet Dorian, who bends down to embrace her.
You're just in time, darling, to witness my signature to Dorian's painting.
Can I sign it, too?
Well, I think you're entitled to.
Thank you haven't missed a sitting. Here. G for Gladys.
He helps her paint a G.
Which do you prefer, Gladys, Dorian Gray or his picture?
I like Dorian best.
You prefer him today, my dear, but when you're a young lady and are turning all the handsome heads in London, you may prefer the portrait. For it'll look just as it does today, but we shall all be changed, and not for the better. Your uncle and I and even Dorian.
Dorian won't change. Dorian will stay just as he is till I'm grown. Won't you, Dorian?
Of course I shall, Dorian.
You must say goodbye now, Tressa. Nanny's waiting. Come along. Hurry.
Basil turns her over to the nanny.
On your way.
For what about me, young lady? Has Dorian Gray stolen you from me completely?
Goodbye, Lord Henry.
When this is known, I shall be torn to shreds in every drawing room in London.
Don't you think a gentleman should remove his hat in the presence of a lady, Parker?
I never take off my hat except when I'm out of doors. Is she as lovely as your sister was, Basil?
Yes. But I'm afraid Dorian has stolen her heart from me, too.
I must congratulate you, Basil. Look at yourself, Mr. Gray.
Lord Henry turns the painting towards Dorian. Seeing his portrait for the first time, Dorian is enchanted. The picture captures his handsome, glowing youth perfectly. He's posed standing next to a small Egyptian statue of a cat, which sits in Basil's studio.
As I grow old, this picture will remain always young. If it were only the other way, if it were I who was always to be young, and the picture that was to grow old.
You would hardly care for such an arrangement, Basil. It would be rather hard lines on your work.
I should object strongly, Harry.
You wouldn't express such a wish in the presence of that cat, Dorian. It's one of the 73 great gods of Egypt, and is quite capable of granting your wish.
Lord Henry is right. I know now that when one loses one's youth, one loses everything.
Perhaps a cup of tea will bring you round, Dorian. You will have some too, won't you, Harry? Or do you object to such simple pleasures?
I adore simple pleasures. They're the last refuge of the complex.
It's more than a painting. It's part of myself.
As soon as you're varnished and framed, Dorian, you will be sent home. Then you can do whatever you like with yourself.
You better send along the Egyptian cat. I don't think the god and the picture should be separated.
I will if Dorian wants it.
If only the picture could change, and I could be always what I am now. For that I would give everything. Yes, there's nothing in the whole world I would not give. I'd give my soul for that.
Dorian gazes in adoration at his own image. The dark, shining hair, the bright, guileless eyes, and the finely chiseled features are without blemish.
Dorian began to venture alone on warm summer evenings into surroundings which were strange to him.
In evening dress, Dorian peers into the window of a tavern called the Two Turtles.
Filled with curiosity about places and people remote from his own experience, he wandered to the half-world of London. The words of Lord Henry vibrating in his mind.
Live. Let nothing be lost upon you. Be afraid of nothing.
He enters the tavern. Eat, drink, and be merry, urges a sign inside the door. The manager notices Dorian because of his posh appearance. Puffing on his cigar, the manager rises and waves a stop to the musical act on the stage just behind him.
The Two Turtles is honored by the visit of a gentleman.
He pulls out a chair at his own table.
If you please, sir.
Smiling a bit self-consciously and watched by the other patrons, Dorian joins the manager at his table. The manager snaps his fingers. Still smiling, Dorian looks around at the other patrons enjoying themselves. Falls.
I give you the sweetheart of the Two Turtles, our own Sybil Vane.
The curtain rises to reveal a demure and poised young beauty. Snow-like confetti wafts down around her from above.
Good The snow was very plentiful, and crumbs were very few. When a weather-beaten sparrow through a mansion window flew, her eye fell on a golden cage. A sweet love song she heard, sung by a pet canary there, a handsome yellow bird. He said to her, "Miss Sparrow, I've been struck by Cupid's arrow. Will you share my cage with me?" She looked up at his castle with its ribbon and its tassel, and in plaintive tones said she, "Goodbye, little yellow bird, I'd rather brave the cold on a leafless tree than a prisoner be in a cage of gold."
I'll gladly introduce you, sir, but she's proud. She won't meet anybody.
Dorian is captivated by her loveliness.
Come, my delightful dove. Descend and make a pilgrimage with me among these mortals.
Sybil steps down from the stage and strolls through the audience. The manager follows, showering her with confetti.
The spoiled and petted yellow bird could scarce believe it true that a common sparrow should refuse a bird with blood so blue. He told her the advantages of riches and of gold. She answered that her liberty for gold could not be sold. She said, "I must be going," but he cried, "No, no, it's snowing, and the wintry winds do blow. Stay with me, my little dearie, for without you 'twould be dreary." But she only sighed.
Sybil pauses when she notices Dorian staring at her raptly. Smiling modestly, she delivers the rest of the song to him.
So goodbye, little yellow bird. I'd rather brave the cold on a leafless tree than a prisoner be.
Dorian's smile captivates Sybil. Then, remembering herself, she hurries backstage, and the curtain drops behind her.
She's taken with you, sir. Say the word, and I'll take you backstage.
Thank you, no.
Night after night, Dorian went to the Two Turtles to watch Sybil Vane.
A patron of the arts, Mrs. Vane. He's come to the Two Turtles each evening for a fortnight. He wants to tell you how much he admires your daughter.
Sybil watches them from her dressing room.
If you will permit me, I have a request to make.
You're very kind, sir.
Miss Vane, will you sing the Little Yellow Bird for me now?
She will so gladly.
But there's no one to play for me. Everyone's gone.
I think I might manage the accompaniment.
You will, won't you, dearie?
Yes.
On one condition.
She retrieves the banknote her mother accepted from Dorian.
Please.
And returns it to him. As Sybil heads for the stage,
I apologize for my daughter.
Mrs. Vane recovers the banknote. When Dorian heads for the piano, she shows it to the manager, who shows her the banknote he has received. A seaman carrying a duffel bag comes in the back door of the tavern. Noticing Sybil on stage, he deposits his duffel bag in her dressing room and turns to watch her sing.
In a cage of
Dorian looks up at Sybil adoringly. She listens to him play with interest. Watching from backstage, the seaman moves closer, trying to see who's at the piano. When Sybil steps down off the stage, the seaman makes his way around to the front. Seeing Dorian at the piano, he looks questioningly at Mrs. Vane, who shushes him. Sybil is irresistibly drawn to Dorian as he plays. Intently, Sybil stands beside Dorian, mesmerized by his playing. Dorian looks up at her.
It's wonderful. Did you write it?
Frédéric Chopin. For a woman he loved. Her name was George Sand. Someday I'll tell you about
them. I should like that.
What did the music mean to you?
I don't know. It is full of emotion. But it's not happy.
No, it's not happy.
Why was he unhappy?
Because he felt his youth slipping away from him.
What an odd thing for you to say.
Why?
You are so young.
Yeah. And you also.
What is the music called? Has it a name?
Kind of name. It is called Prelude.
His eyes fixed on hers, Dorian rises. She looks at him with adoring trust. Moving into each other's arms, they kiss passionately. The seaman glares at Sybil's mother and stalks out. Reluctantly, Mrs. Vane goes after him. Stepping away from Sybil, Dorian collects his top hat, cape, and cane. He gives her a hurt look, which she returns, eyes wide and innocent. Then he goes out. Backstage...
Is this the way you watch over Sybil, Mother?
You don't understand these things, James. Your
I wish I wasn't going to Australia at all. I'd chuck up the whole thing if my articles hadn't been signed.
I want Sybil to make a brilliant marriage. Actresses often marry into the upper classes. I almost did myself at one time.
Who is this young dandy? What's his name?
Oh, I don't know his name, but he's rich.
What's his name, Sybil? How often has he been here? What are his intentions?
I don't know his intentions, but I do know his name. It is Sir Tristan.
You don't even know his name, and yet you permitted him to...
Your brother's right, Sybil. You ought not to have permitted such familiarity.
He is good. I know it. There is no evil in him. Did you see his face?
No, but I wish I had, because if he ever does you any wrong, I'll track him down and kill him.
Jim! You're foolish, Jim. Utterly foolish. You talk like one of the melodramas Mother used to act in.
That was when acting was understood. I received a great deal of gratifying attention in those days.
All I say is watch over Sybil, Mother. Watch over her while I'm gone.
Jim.
Sybil stands near a small picture of Sir Tristan, a romantic knight in shining armor. Stepping over to Jim, she turns him to face her.
You're going away tonight. The ship will take you far away over the dark waters. Don't let me remember you angry and troubled.
They embrace. Watching them, Mrs. Vane dabs away a tear with her handkerchief.
That's better. Can't you read what people are in their faces?
She turns toward the picture.
You think I'm silly when I call him Sir Tristan. But to me, he's like one of King Arthur's knights that we used to read about when we were children, who took the vow of chivalry to battle against all evildoers, to defend the right to protect all women to be true in friendship and faithful in love.
In a bird shop...
You can't get along with this one, sir. I've never heard a sweeter warbler.
Dorian considers a little yellow bird in a gilded cage. Nodding at the shopkeeper, he reaches for his wallet. The cage sits below the picture of Sir Tristan in Sybil's dressing room. She's delighted with the bird.
Little yellow bird.
At a lunch party...
Late as usual, Harry.
Please forgive me, Aunt Agatha.
Punctuality is the thief of time, Harry says.
Victoria, darling, how nice.
I love coming to your house, Aunt Agatha. It's one of the few places I'm likely to meet my husband. Oh, I'm always dropping it. Mr. Gray has something terribly important to tell you, Harry. We're all dying to learn what it is.
I imagine it can wait until luncheon is over.
I'm vexed with you, Harry. Why do you try to persuade Mr. Gray to give up the East End? He's a wonderful musician and they love his playing.
The East End is a very important problem.
Quite so. It's the problem of slavery. And we try to solve it by amusing the slaves.
I suspect, Lord Henry, we're interested in the poor in order to amuse ourselves. Especially as we grow older and are unfit for other amusements.
Ah, Lord Henry, I wish you'd tell me how to become young again.
Can you remember any great errors that you committed in your early days, Duchess?
Great many, I fear.
Then commit them over again. To regain one's youth, one has merely to repeat one's follies.
A delightful theory.
And a dangerous theory.
One of the great secrets of life. Most people die of a sort of creeping common sense and discover too late that the only things one never regrets are one's mistakes.
But surely if one lives for oneself, one pays a terrible price for doing so.
Yes, we're overcharged for everything nowadays.
One has to pay in other ways than money.
What sort of ways, Sir Thomas?
I should fancy in remorse, in suffering, in, well, in the consciousness of degradation.
No civilized man ever regrets a pleasure, and no uncivilized man ever knows what a pleasure is.
I know what pleasure is. It's to adore someone.
In that case, I think I can guess what it is you have to tell me that is so important. But adoring someone is certainly better than being adored. Being adored is a nuisance. You'll discover, Dorian, that women treat us just as humanity treats its gods. They worship us and keep bothering us to do something for them.
Harry, you're incorrigible.
You must admit that women give men the very gold of their life.
But they invariably want it back in such small change. Women, as a witty Frenchman put it, inspire us with the desire to do masterpieces and always prevent us from carrying them out.
I don't understand you.
You seem to know us women awfully well, Lord Henry.
I'm analyzing women at present. The subject is less difficult than I was led to believe. Women represent the triumph of matter over mind, just as men represent the triumph of mind over morals.
These views are horrifying, Lady Agatha. I did not expect to hear the devil's advocate at your table.
I apologize for the intelligence of my remarks, Sir Thomas. I'd forgotten that you were a member of Parliament.
Outraged, Sir Thomas stands.
You will forgive me, Lady Agatha, if I leave at once.
Before the quail, Sir Thomas, the first quail of the season, I ordered them especially for you.
No, surely not before the quail, Sir Thomas. Think with the Liberals and eat with the Tories. Isn't that the rule?
Dear me, how men argue. I can never make out what they're talking about.
Do sit down, Sir Thomas. Lord Henry's ideas are demoralizing and delightful, but they are not to be taken seriously.
Sir Thomas's anger dissipates with the steam rising from the tray of succulent quail. Finally, he smiles sheepishly.
I confess, I never could resist Lady Agatha's quail.
Later in the garden...
Well, Dorian, what have you to tell me that is so important? From what you said at luncheon, my guess is that you've fallen in love.
I'm engaged to be married.
Lord Henry looks up in startled amusement. That evening, Basil joins Lord Henry in a cab.
Now that we're on our way, Harry, perhaps you'll tell me where we're going.
Grosvenor Square, number 7.
Oh, it's Dorian we're going to see.
Yes, we're going to pick him up, and then we're going to see the young woman he's engaged to marry.
Dorian engaged? To whom, Harry?
To an actress in a cheap vaudeville.
An actress? With dyed hair and a painted face.
Don't run down dyed hair and painted faces, Basil. There's an extraordinary charm in them.
Surely you can't be serious.
I hope I shall never be more serious.
You don't approve. You can't possibly.
I never approve or disapprove of anything. Dorian Gray falls in love with a beautiful girl and proposes to marry her. Why not? Every experience is of value, and whatever can be said against marriage, it's certainly an experience. Dorian Gray will make this girl his wife and 6 months later become infatuated with someone else. You think he can be so unfaithful?
Faithfulness is merely laziness.
Number 7, sir.
I've been watching for you. Go to Lower Euston Road, number 22.
Lower Euston Road, sir?
Lower Euston Road.
Yes, sir.
Dorian climbs into the cab.
They're always surprised when I give them that address. Hurry! I want you to get there in time to meet her before she sings.
I hope you'll always be as happy as you are at this moment, Dorian.
Thank you, Beth. course, our engagement's still a dead secret. She's not even told her mother.
What will your guardian say of it?
Lord Bradley's sure to be furious, but there's nothing he can do.
May I ask you a question, Lorien? At what particular point did you mention marriage?
I didn't make any formal proposal, Harry. I told her I loved her, and she said she was not worthy to be my wife. Not worthy.
Women are wonderfully practical. In situations of that kind, we often forget to say anything about marriage, and they always remind us.
Sybil has made me forget your poisonous theories, Harry.
Which theories, Dorian?
Theories about life, about pleasure.
Pleasure is the only thing worth having a theory about. It's nature's sign of approval. When we're happy, we're always good. When we're good, we're not always happy.
Sybil is the answer to all your cynicism, Harry. I believe you'll understand that when you see her.
At the tavern. Sybil smiles sweetly at Dorian, then runs backstage.
This marriage is quite right. I didn't think so at first, but the moment we met her, I was convinced of it. She's charming and innocent, transparently so.
I knew you would say that.
She's all that you say, but I don't agree with Basil. I believe she loves you so much you have no need to marry her.
What wickedness are you contemplating now?
I ought to be angry with you, Harry, but I'm much too happy. All I know is that Sybil is sacred.
Certain sacred things are worth touching.
I begin to find you disgusting. Don't listen to him, Dorian.
Don't worry, Basil. I'm immune to his ideas now.
In that case, I needn't tell you how I should proceed if I were in your place.
What would you do, Harry? I'm curious to know.
Well, I should invite her to come to my house to see Basil's portrait. Then, when she said it was time for her to go home, I should ask her not to leave. She'd be shocked, of course. I'd pretend to be disappointed in her. If she still wished to go, I'd become cold and indifferent. I'd ask her to let herself out, saying that I couldn't bear sad farewells or something equally appropriate. But if after that she left, then I'd believe her to be as good as she's beautiful, and I'd beg her forgiveness and marry her.
I've always thought your wickedness imposed. I know better now. You're an unmitigated cad.
Will you try my experiment, Dorian?
Dorian brightens as Sybil appears. He leads her to their table.
Miss Vane, has Sir Tristan, as you have so charmingly called him, ever invited you to see the wonderful portrait that Basil Hallward has made of him?
No, he hasn't. I should love to see it. May I?
Of course you may, darling. Tonight, if you wish.
At home, under the gaze of his portrait, Dorian plays for Sybil. Rising from the piano bench, she looks around the drawing room.
I shall always remember this room, just as it is now. The lamplight, you, the piano, my own happiness.
Sybil looks from the clock to Dorian and smiles sweetly. It's 2 a.m. Picking up her hat, she steps over to a mirror.
Your clock thinks it's time for me to go home.
Clocks can't help being disagreeable. They think it's their duty.
As she pins her hat on, Sybil sees something in the mirror. She turns to stare at the Egyptian cat statue.
It's that cat. I thought I saw its eyes move.
Perhaps you did. Lord Henry says it's one of the 73 great gods of Egypt.
Doesn't it frighten you?
Does a little.
He picks up a book.
Listen to this. Dawn follows dawn, and nights grow old, and all the while this curious cat lies crouching on the Chinese mat with eyes of satin, rimmed with gold. Get hence, you loathsome mystery. Hideous animal, get hence. You wake in me each bestial sense. You make me what I would not be. You make my creed a barren sham. You wake foul dreams of sensual life.
His eyes rise slowly from the book and fix on hers.
What a strange poem. Who wrote it?
A brilliant young Irishman out of Oxford. His name is Oscar Wilde.
Why do you look at me so strangely?
What would you do, Sybil, if I should say to you, don't leave me now. Don't go home.
She looks at him in surprise. The light dwindles from her eyes, and she bows her head in shame.
What would you do, Sybil?
She looks up at him, tears glistening on her cheeks. Then she turns away from him and walks falteringly toward the door. At the foyer, she pauses.
I suppose I should have expected a conventional reaction. Good night, then.
Good night.
You don't mind letting yourself out, do you? I can't bear sad farewells.
Sybil shakes her head. Then, as her face dissolves in tears, she starts across the foyer to the front door. Dorian sets the book down. Standing in front of his portrait, he listens for the sound of the front door. When he doesn't hear it, he steps over to the piano. With a glance toward the foyer, he sits down. At the front door, Sybil hears the prelude. Glancing up from the keys, Dorian sees something. He pretends not to notice as Sybil's shadow returns hesitantly from the foyer. She follows it into the doorway. Reluctantly but irresistibly, Sybil is drawn back to Dorian. Eyes lowered, she stands before him, resigned. Dorian finishes the prelude. Then his eyes rise slowly and fix on her. The next day, Dorian sits at the desk in his bedroom, preparing to write a letter.
A wise friend warned me that your innocence, upon which I would have staked my life, would fail to meet the test I set before you. I called his wisdom cynicism, but now I know better. You have killed my love. You have been false, not to me, but to the ideal I had formed of you. You used to stir my imagination. Now you are nothing to me. I will never see you again. I will never mention your name. I will never think of you. Henceforth, I shall live only for pleasure. Everything else is meaningless. And if this leads me to the destruction of my soul, then it is only you who are responsible. Do not try to see me. I shall leave England and not return for a long time. I am sending with this letter a gift of money, which will compensate you for any disappointment you may feel. I have been living in a land of illusions. Now I shall make an end of dreams. My real life begins, my own life, in which you cannot possibly have any part.
In her dressing room, Sybil looks in despair from Dorian's letter to the sheaf of banknotes that came with it. As the finality of Dorian's words sink in, her despair deepens. Early one morning, Dorian returns home, still in his evening clothes.
In spite of himself, Dorian was troubled by what he had done. His uneasy conscience made him avoid those he knew. All night he had wandered alone through the dimly lit streets and evil-looking houses of the London half-world. When at last he returned to his silent, shuttered house in Mayfair, he could not overcome a sense of something ominous impending.
Leaving his cape and hat in the foyer, he heads for the stairs.
His eye fell on the portrait Basil Hallward had painted of him.
Arrested on the stairs by what he glimpsed, Dorian turns back to the drawing room. Perturbed, he makes his way over to the portrait and stares up at it.
In the dim, shaded light, the face appeared to him to be a little changed. The expression looked somehow different. One would have said that there was a touch of cruelty in the mouth. It was very strange.
Dorian crosses over to the window and opens the drapes, letting in the light. Apprehensively, he returns to the portrait.
There was no doubt that the whole expression had altered. The lines of cruelty about the mouth were unmistakable.
Dorian is alarmed. Turning from the portrait, he studies his own face in a mirror.
There was no such expression on his face.
He remembers his earlier words.
If only the picture could change and I could be always as I am now. For that I would give everything. Yes, there's nothing in the whole world I would not give. I would give my soul for that.
The cat statue sits behind him on a table.
But surely his wish had not been fulfilled. Such things were impossible. It was monstrous even to think of it. What if someone else observed the horrible change? His valet, perhaps. What if Basil Hallward came and asked to look at his own picture?
He conceals the painting behind a tall folding screen.
But he was being ridiculous. This was a mere hallucination, an illusion brought on by his troubled senses. The picture had not changed. He was mad to think so. A painted canvas could not alter. He would look at it again after he had slept, when he was calmer, and he would laugh at this fantastic idea.
He closes the drawing room doors.
But in the afternoon, when he returned to examine the portrait again, fantastic as the idea was, his memory of that cruel look was disturbingly vivid.
Dorian moves the screen aside, but then hesitates to look at the painting. He forces himself.
It was true. The expression had altered. There was no doubt of it. It was incredible. And yet it was a fact. Was this portrait to become for him the emblem of his own conscience? Would it teach him to loathe his own soul? But if this painting was to be his conscience made visible, then he would let it instruct him. He would give it no reason to reproach him. He would live purely and nobly.
Determination inspires him.
He had been cruel to Sybil Vane, but it was not too late to make that right. She could still be his wife. He would marry her. They could be happy together. He implored her forgiveness. He blamed himself. He gave way to the luxury of self-reproach. When he finished the letter, he felt that he had been forgiven.
Dorian, let me in. I must see you. Open the door, Dorian. I'll not go away until I see you.
In front of the closed doors, he hesitates. Then he steps over to the screen and slides it in front of the portrait.
Dorian, let me in.
Locked yourself in like this, Dorian. I'm sorry for it all, dreadfully sorry.
You mean about Sybil Vane?
Yes, of course.
It's all right now, Harry. I'm actually grateful to you. I've learned to know myself better. I know you will sneer at me, but from now on I'm going to do what my conscience bids me.
What on earth are you talking about?
About Sybil Vane. I'm going to marry her.
Marry her?
I know what you're going to say. Something cynical about marriage. Don't say it. 2 weeks ago I asked Sybil to marry me. I'm not going to break my word to her.
Then you don't know.
Know what?
Haven't you read the morning paper?
No, I haven't.
Suddenly apprehensive, he turns to face Lord Henry.
What is it, Harry? What's happened?
Gravely, Lord Henry walks past him.
Sybil Vane is dead.
Dorian is dumbstruck. Lord Henry looks for a reaction. Dorian is stunned. As the terrible news sinks in, he turns slowly to the new letter on his desk.
That's why I had it here to see you. I didn't want you to see anyone until I came. When I found you'd locked yourself in, I assumed you knew about it. There'll be an inquest and you mustn't get mixed up in it. They don't know your name at the theatre, I suppose, and if they don't, it's all right.
Did Sybil tell me everything, Harry?
It was obviously not an accident, though I suppose it must be put that way to the public. 12:30 or so, she was leaving the theatre with her mother when she said she'd forgotten something and went back to her dressing room. She didn't come down again. They found her lying on the floor. She'd swallowed something. By mistake, they say. She died instantaneously. It's tragic, of course, but you mustn't let yourself brood over it. You must learn to see it in its proper perspective. For the moment, you must put it out of your mind. You must come and dine with me, and afterwards we'll look in at the opera. It's Don Giovanni. Everybody will be there, and you can come to my sister's box.
So I have murdered Sybil Vane. As surely as if I'd cut her throat.
I can't see why you should blame yourself. I suppose you had a quarrel and she foolishly thought she'd lost you. But no woman destroys herself who isn't already unbalanced. Where do you keep your sherry?
If you'd married this girl, you would have been wretched, and so in time would she have been. I assure you, the whole thing would have been an absolute failure.
I remember your saying once there's a fatality about good resolutions. They're always made too late. Mine certainly were.
You should look upon this tragedy as an episode and the wonderful spectacle of life.
What is it that has really happened? Someone has killed herself for love of you. I wish that I had had such an experience. The women who have admired me, there have been some, have always insisted on living on long after I've ceased to care for them, or they to care for me. They've become stout and tedious. And when I meet them, they go in at once for reminiscences. That awful memory of woman. Drink this to make you feel better. I found myself sitting next to such a woman the other night at dinner. She had once proposed to sacrifice the whole world for me. That's always a dreadful moment. It fills one with the terror of eternity. It happened years ago, but she insisted on dragging the whole thing out again, and she assured me that I'd spoiled her life. However, she ate an enormous dinner. Not one of the women I've known would have done for me what Sybil Vane did for you. But you haven't told me yet whether you will dine with me tonight.
I don't feel up to it, Harry.
Then perhaps you'll join me later at the opera.
Dorian holds the letter to a candle flame and then tosses it burning into the fireplace.
I hope to see you before 9:30. I don't want you to miss the rescue in the duet. La ci darem la mano.
That evening, Basil arrives in the rain to pay his condolences at Dorian's house. The butler opens the door.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hallward. Mr. Gray isn't in. He's gone to the opera.
To the opera?
Yes, sir. Is there any message, sir?
No, I'll come by in the morning.
The next morning in Dorian's drawing room, Basil notices sheet music for Little Yellow Bird on the piano. Recognizing the song, he picks it up. As Basil picks out the melody, Dorian comes down the stairs.
But in the morning, Dorian no longer wanted the consolation of his friend, nor his reproaches. His pride and his sense of guilt prompted him to assume an air of indifference.
Dorian purses his lips. Basil looks up when he hears the whistling.
Hello, Basil. Sorry to keep you. Have you had breakfast?
Yes, I have. Thank you.
I'm famished. You don't mind if I have a bite while we talk?
Of course not.
Soon, in the garden...
You went to the opera while Sybil Vane was lying dead in some sordid lodging.
What is past is past.
You call yesterday the past?
It's only shallow people who require years to get rid of an emotion. A man who is master of himself can end a sorrow as easily as he can invent a pleasure. I don't want to be at the mercy of my emotions. I want to use them, enjoy them, and dominate them.
Something has changed you completely, Dorian. You look exactly the same. You talk as if you had no heart, no pity in you.
You've come too late. If you had come in yesterday at a particular moment, about 5:30 or 5:45, you would have seen how deeply I was affected. Even Harry, who brought me the news, had no idea what I was going through. I suffered immensely. Then it passed away. I cannot repeat an emotion. No one can.
This isn't you talking, Dorian. These are Harry's ideas.
It has nothing to do with Harry.
I suppose Harry didn't give you that yellow book I saw on your table.
What's wrong with that book?
Everything. It's vile, evil, corrupt, decadent. I detest it.
What would you like me to read, Basil?
Basil stops sketching on the sheet music and gets up.
Since you ask me?
He hands Dorian a small book.
The Light of Asia.
I'm never without it.
The story of Buddha, isn't it?
The story of Buddha, a good man. Promise me you'll read it, Dorian.
I promise.
Dorian sets the book down and then notices the sheet music in Basil's hand.
Oh, you've got a sketch of Sybil. It's charming. May I have it?
Of course. I must go now, Dorian.
I'm relieved to find you in such good spirits in spite of what has happened.
Thank you, Basil. It's good of you to be so concerned.
In the drawing room, Basil turns back.
Before I go, I'd like to look at the painting I did of you.
Dorian turns in alarm.
But there's a screen in front of it. I thought the room looked different when I came in.
The light was too strong on the portrait.
Surely not. It's an admirable place for you.
Basil strides over to the painting. As he reaches for the screen...
Wait. You must not look at it.
Not look at my own work? You're not serious. Why shouldn't I look at it?
I don't offer any explanation, and you're not to ask for any. But if you try to look at that picture, Basil, on my word of honor, I will never speak to you again.
What on earth is the matter with you? I'm planning to exhibit it next month. That's why I wanted to look at it.
Exhibit it? But you told me a month ago you would never exhibit it. You told Harry the same thing.
At that time, the painting had a strange fascination for me. It seemed almost to have a life of its own. It affected me so much, I felt I couldn't let it be seen publicly. Perhaps you've seen the same mysterious quality in it, Dorian. Have you noticed something curious in the painting? Something that probably at first did not strike you, but that revealed itself to you suddenly?
I see you did.
I saw something in it. Something that seemed to be very curious. You were right. There can be something fatal about a portrait.
I think I understand what you feel about it. I respect your vision. Perhaps someday you'll recover from it, as I did. At any rate, I'll certainly not let it destroy our friendship.
I'm glad of that.
Goodbye, Dorian.
Goodbye, Basil.
Standing next to the table on which the Egyptian cat sits, Dorian turns toward the painting.
It has been mad of him to allow the thing to remain, even for an hour, in a room to which any of his friends had access. Henceforth, he must be on his guard against everyone.
An idea comes to Dorian. He turns to face the stairs. At the top of them is a closed door.
At the top of the house was his old schoolroom, which had not been used for years. No one ever entered it. Nothing was in it but his old school books and his toys gathering dust and cobwebs. The picture could be safely hidden away there. He could lock it up. He himself would keep the key. There was no need for the servants ever to enter the room.
Lifting a satin coverlet from a sofa, he shakes it out and considers its size against the painting behind the screen. Later, in the attic schoolroom, he watches his servants lean the covered painting against a pillar and then walk out. From the doorway, he watches them descend the stairs.
He would have to let Victor go. And the others. He must bring new servants into the house.
Dorian turns back to the portrait. As he steps toward it, he knocks over a toy knight on horseback.
In this room, every moment of his childhood in its stainless purity came back to him. Here, among the innocent souvenirs of his childhood, the hideous portrait would be forever hidden away. A face painted in the canvas could grow bestial, sodden, and unclean. No one would ever see it. No one, except himself.
He approaches his old school desk.
He was to have eternal youth while the portrait bore the burden of his shame.
A sharp-pointed knife sticks in the desktop. He pulls it out.
He was caught in an evil destiny.
He plunks the knife into a heart-shaped carving in the desktop.
As the years passed, the miracle of Dorian's changeless youth caused wonder, but rarely suspicion. Even those who had heard the most evil things against him, the strange rumors about his mode of life, which spread through London and became the chatter of the clubs, could not believe anything to his dishonor when they saw him. He He had always the look of one who had kept himself unspotted from the world.
At a garden party, Dorian chats amiably with Lord Henry.
But while he fascinated many, there were not a few who distrusted him. Curious stories were current about him. It was rumored that he had been seen in a low den in the distant parts of Whitechapel. His extraordinary absences became notorious. And when he reappeared again in society, men would whisper to each other in corners or pass him with a sneer or look at him with cold, searching eyes. Some of those who had been most intimate with him appeared after a time to shun him. Women who, for his sake, had set convention at defiance were seen to grow pale if Dorian Gray entered the room. He could not endure to be long out of England or to be separated from the picture that was such a part of his life. He was afraid that during his absence someone might gain access to the room where it was hidden. Then suddenly, some night, he would go down to dreadful places near Blue Gate Field and stay there day after day.
In a shabby building near the waterfront, Dorian, dressed in his fine top hat and cape, buys a bottle of liquor and a single glass. He leaves them with a tip for the pianist, an old man who smiles up at him in recognition. Behind Dorian, a door opens and a dwarfish man steps into the room. Almost reluctantly, Dorian turns away from the music. Walking through the door, he pauses at the foot of a shadowy staircase and then starts up as the dwarfish man follows, closing the door behind them. Later, in his attic schoolroom...
When he had recovered from these visits to the abyss, he would stand in front of the picture, sometimes loathing it and himself, but filled at other times with that pride of individualism that is half the fascination of evil. He would examine with minute care the hideous lines that scarred the wrinkling forehead or crawled around the heavy sensual mouth, wondering which were more horrible, the signs of sin or the signs of age. He found reasons to justify his actions. He told himself that man was a being with myriad lives and myriad sensations. To live a simple, sincere, honest life was hardly to live at all. Was insincerity such a terrible thing? Dorian thought not. It was merely a method by which we could multiply our personalities. Yet there was one person towards whom he found it difficult to be insincere. It was Basil Hallward's niece Gladys, who had loved him since he was a child.
In his bedroom, Dorian hears the music coming from downstairs as he admires a photo of Gladys, who is now grown up. Returning the photo to his desk, he gets up. He finds Gladys at the piano in the drawing room.
A leafless tree than a prisoner bee in a cage of gold.
She smiles at Dorian.
I was close by and came in for a moment. Found this old song in your piano bench is charming. So is the face that my uncle sketched on it. He did do it, didn't he? I know his style so well.
She puts down the sheet music.
Did she sing this song? Who is she? Do tell me about her.
She died many years ago, when you were only a little girl.
Did you love her very much, Dorian?
Yes.
Gladys gazes at him lovingly.
Goodbye, Dorian. I'm looking forward to your party tonight. I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Your party's always on.
She goes out, leaving the sketch of Sybil on the piano. In Basil's studio, there's a sketch of Gladys.
I'm not really as lovely as that picture, am I, darling?
No, of course not.
I think I've discovered why Dorian hasn't proposed to me. And I've decided what to do about it.
And what have you decided to do about it?
I'm going to ask him to marry me. Tonight, perhaps.
What about David Stone? Do you think he'd take you to Dorian's party tonight if he knew what your intentions were?
Of course he would. Nothing petty about David. I don't intend to tell him.
No, don't tell David.
David, you cad. I never thought you'd be an eavesdropper.
Don't be alarmed about Dorian Gray, Mr. Hallward. I'm the one Gladys will marry.
Of course, I have nothing to say about
him. Even if you weren't going to marry me, I wouldn't let you marry that devil.
I'll not have you say anything against him, David.
I don't have to. There are plenty of others to say it for me.
Lies and jealousy, all of it. There's no evil in Dorian. Anybody can see that by looking at him.
Well, he hasn't asked you yet. I'll say that for him.
You heard what I said. I'm going to ask him myself tonight.
In front of all those people, I suppose.
I'll get him alone. It's a big house.
Good night, sir.
Good night, David.
That evening at Dorian's party, a Siamese dancer moves her arms sensuously. As the other guests watch the hypnotic show, Gladys turns to gaze at Dorian. He is gazing back. Sitting with the other guests, David notices the intimate glances exchanged by Gladys and Dorian. Nearby, the Egyptian cat statue sits on a table. Later...
What's wrong, Dorian? Why don't you answer me? Is there something else, something I don't know about?
You must have heard the stories they tell of me.
Don't they frighten you?
I don't believe them.
Suppose I were to tell you that they're true.
I will never believe anything evil of you.
Dorian smiles faintly at her.
What do you know of evil?
I only know there is none in you. If you had some great trouble, Dorian, I would want to share it.
If I were to marry you, it would be an incredible wickedness.
Is that a way of saying it? You don't love me?
As he fastens a jeweled necklace around her throat, Dorian smiles ruefully.
If you like.
Struggling to maintain her composure, Gladys steps over to the mirror to admire the necklace.
Very beautiful, Dorian. Thank you. Will you find David for me? I must go now.
As Dorian goes out, she watches him in the mirror. From the foyer, Dorian spots David trying the schoolroom door at the top of the stairs. Finding it locked, David turns and notices Dorian.
I've been exploring your house, Dorian. You don't mind, do you? It's better than a museum.
I see.
You must have some priceless possessions in that room if you keep them locked up. May I see them sometime? What rare things have you stored away there, Dorian?
Skeletons of inquisitive guests.
I suspected as much.
I want to leave now, David.
Of course.
Good night, Dorian.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
As they head for the front door, Dorian returns to the drawing room and crosses to the window. Pushing aside the curtain, he watches them go. On a foggy night...
It was the 9th of November, the eve of his own 38th birthday, as Dorian often remembered afterwards. He was walking home about 11 o'clock from Lord Henry's, where he had been dining. A strange sense of fear, for which he could not account, came over him at the sight of Basil Hallward, and prevented him from making any sign of recognition.
Basil turns.
Dorian! I thought it was you, or your fur coat, but I wasn't sure. Didn't you recognize me?
In this fog, I can't even recognize Grosvenor Square. I think my house must be somewhere about here, but I'm not certain of it.
I've been waiting for you in your library ever since 9 o'clock. Finally, I took pity on your man and told him to go to bed. I'm off to Paris on the midnight train, and I particularly wanted to see you before I left. Bit of luck running into you like this.
I'm sorry you're going away. I haven't seen you in ages. I suppose you'll be back soon.
No, I shall be out of England for several months. I'm going to take a studio in Paris and shut myself up until I finish a picture I have in my head. Gladys is coming over to join me later on. May I come in for a moment?
Won't you miss your train?
It doesn't leave until 12:15. It's only just 11. As a matter of fact, I was on my way to the club to look for you. There won't be any delay about my luggage, as I've sent out my heavy things. All I have with me is in this bag.
Come in, or the fog will get into the house.
Inside.
I hope you're not going to talk about anything serious. Nothing is serious nowadays. At least nothing should be.
What I have to say to you is serious, Dorian. Don't try like that. You make it so much more difficult for me.
I hope it's not about myself. I'm tired of myself.
It is about yourself. And I must say it to you.
I'll only keep you half an hour.
You sound terrifying, Basil.
It's for your sake I'm speaking. I think you should know the things that are being said against you in London.
I don't want to know them. I love scandals about other people, but scandals about myself don't interest me. They lack novelty.
In the drawing room...
You must be interested in your own reputation.
Dorian takes out his coin collection.
Mind you, I don't believe these rumors. I can't believe them when I see you. There aren't any secret vices. Such things write themselves across a man's face. You, with your untroubled youth, I find it hard to credit anything against you. But when I hear all these hideous things that people whisper about you, I don't know what to say.
I absolve you from the necessity of defending me if that's what's troubling you.
You can't dismiss these charges so lightly. Why does a man like the Duke of Herrick leave the room of a club when you enter it?
Not because he knows anything about my life, Basil, but because I know everything about his.
But why are your friendships so fatal to people? There was that wretched boy in the guards who committed suicide. What about Adrian Singleton and Lord Wayne's son? What gentleman will be seen with either of them?
The wretched boy in the guards was so insanely in love with the woman he felt he couldn't live without her. Am I to blame for that? Wayne's silly son marries a woman no one will receive. Is that my fault? Adrian Singleton writes his friend's name across her bill. Am I his keeper?
Still, one has a right to judge a man by the effect he has on his friends. Yours seem filled with an insatiable madness for pleasure.
Dorian examines a coin.
And when I think how fond Gladys is of you.
What has Gladys to do with it?
Nothing, I hope. And nothing in the future if I can prevent it. I'm told things that seems impossible to doubt. Lord Wallace was one of my greatest friends at Oxford. He showed me a letter that his wife had written when she was dying alone in her villa at Montone. Your name was implicated in the most terrible confession I ever read. I told him it was absurd, that I knew you and that you were incapable of anything of the kind. No. Do I know you? Before I could answer that, I should have to see your soul.
Dorian considers this with horror.
To see my soul?
Yes, to see your soul. But only God can do that.
Dorian slowly reaches a decision. He turns to Basil.
You should see it yourself, tonight. Why shouldn't you look at it? It's your own handiwork. You can tell the world all about it afterward if you like. No one will believe you. You've chatted enough about corruption. Now you look at it. I'll show you myself.
I can make no sense out of what you're saying, Dorian. I only ask you to give me some answer to the horrible charges that are made against you. Tell me they're untrue from beginning to end, and I'll believe you.
Come upstairs, Basil. I keep a diary of my life from day to day. It never leaves the room in which it is written. I'll show it to you.
I don't want to read anything. All I want is a plain answer to my question.
You'll find that upstairs. You won't have to read long.
Mystified, Basil steps over to look into Dorian's unblinking eyes. Then he heads for the stairs. As Dorian follows him, the cat statue seems to watch them go. Upstairs, Dorian opens the door to the darkened schoolroom and follows Basil inside. He lights a hanging lamp.
You're the one man in the world who's entitled to know everything about me. You've had more to do with my life than you think.
While Basil frowns in confusion, Dorian closes the door.
You think it's only God who sees the soul.
Stepping over to the portrait and watching Basil's face, he pulls off the coverlet. Basil stares at the portrait in shocked disbelief. Smiling faintly to himself, Dorian plucks the knife from the heart carved into the top of his school desk. As Basil stands transfixed before the painting, Dorian plunks the knife into the desktop, then pulls it out.
In spite of the indescribable corruption of the portrait, Basil was still able to recognize his painting of Dorian.
As Dorian stabs the desktop, Basil raises the hanging lamp to better illuminate the painting.
It is from within, apparently, that the foulness and horror came.
The fresh-faced youth is gone.
It was as if some moral leprosy were eating the thing away.
The Dorian Gray in the picture has become grotesque, a diseased and hideous monstrosity of a man.
He could not believe that he had made this portrait, yet there was his own name, just as he had painted it.
Dorian continues to toy with the knife as he observes Basil. Overwhelmed, Basil finds his way past a table to a chair and sinks into it.
But this is monstrous. It's beyond nature, beyond reason. What does it mean?
On the day you finished this painting, I made a wish. Perhaps you would call it a prayer. My wish was granted.
You told me you had destroyed my painting.
I was wrong. It has destroyed me.
As the eyes of a devil.
Each of us has heaven and hell in it.
But if this is true, if this is what you've done with your life, it is far worse than anything that's been said of you.
He turns somberly to Dorian.
Do you know how to pray, Dorian?
Dorian flings the knife into the desk again.
What is it we were taught to say in our boyhood? Lead us not into temptation. Forgive us our sins. Wash away our iniquities. Let us say them together.
It's too late, Basil.
The prayer of your pride was answered. The prayer of your repentance may be answered also.
You think I haven't tried? I tell you it's no use.
Isn't there a verse somewhere? Though your sins be as scarlet, yet I will make them white as snow.
Basil turns from him to the painting.
Only last week, Gladys recalled the day this painting was finished. She remembered putting her initial under my signature. There it is, just as she made it. If she could see it now.
The thought appalls Dorian.
I can still pray, Dorian, if you can't.
Gladys must never know. Yet sometimes, somehow, Basil might reveal his secret to her. The one person in the world whose good opinion was indispensable to him.
Dorian stares coldly at Basil.
An uncontrollable feeling of hatred for Basil came over him, together with a terror of the knowledge he had given him and the use he might make of it. Panic seized him. He felt like a hunted animal, cornered, desperate.
Grabbing the knife, Dorian stabs Basil in the back. As he slumps across the table, bumping the hanging lamp, Dorian stabs him again. And again. The lamp swings back and forth, plunging Dorian's face from light into shadow as he stares expressionlessly at his victim. Tossing aside the knife, he peers at the blood on his hands. An embroidered shawl lies on the keyboard of his childhood piano. Picking it up, he uses it to wipe the blood from his hand, meticulously. His hands spotless, he tosses the shawl onto Basil's dead body. Then he glances up at the portrait.
It was as if the painting had sweated a dew of blood.
The painted hand glistens with blood. Fetching a stepladder, Dorian recovers the painting. Then he stills the swinging lamp and looks down at the body.
He felt that he had struck a mortal blow not only at his friend, but at himself. It seemed to him unbearable that what he had done could never be undone.
Dorian extinguishes the lamp and goes out. Locking the door behind him, he pauses before descending the stairs.
Basil was dead. Men were strangled in England for what he had done. And yet what evidence was there against him? Basil had left the house at 11. No one had seen him come in again. Most of the servants were at Selby. His valet had gone to bed. Paris. It was to Paris that Basil had gone by the midnight train, as he had intended.
In his foyer, he dresses to go out. Stepping out the front door, he checks to see that he's not observed. Then he gently closes the door and pulls the doorbell. The valet emerges from his room in his robe and pajamas and hurries to answer the door. Dorian enters and drops his walking stick into the stand.
I'm sorry to wake you, Francis. I forgot my latchkey. What time is it?
12:30, sir.
12:30. You must wake me at 9 in the morning. I have some work to do.
Yes, sir.
He gives Francis his coat and scarf.
Did anyone call this evening?
Mr. Hallward, sir. He stayed till 11, and then he went to catch his train. He said he was leaving for Paris.
I'm sorry I didn't see him. Did he leave any message?
He said he would write you from Paris if he didn't find you at your club.
Thank you, Francis.
Is there anything more, sir?
I'm going to write a letter. I'd like to deliver it by hand early in the morning. It's for Mr. Alan Campbell. You'll find the address on the envelope.
Yes, sir. Good night, sir.
Seated at the desk in his drawing room, Dorian begins writing.
In the morning when Alan Campbell received his letter, he would come. He would come at once. Alan would help him. He was the only one who could help him now. But what if Alan Campbell should be out of England? Days would pass before he could come back. Perhaps he would refuse to come.
Later that morning, Francis opens the drawing room door.
Mr. Alan Campbell, sir.
This is kind of you, Alan.
Still wearing his coat, Alan Campbell avoids Dorian's gaze.
You said it was a matter of life and death.
Listen to this. I sent my soul through the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell. And by my soul returned to me and answered, I myself am heaven and hell.
Standing by the cat statue, he regards his guest.
That's quite good, don't you think?
I didn't come here to discuss the verses of Omar Khayyam.
No, of course not. Please sit down, Alan. I'll tell you why I sent for you.
Campbell remains standing.
Alan, in the locked room at the top of this house, a room to which no one but myself has access, a dead man is lying across the table. He's been dead for 10 hours. Who he is, why he died, how he died, are matters that do not concern you. What you must do is...
There's no need for you to go on, Dorian. Your horrible secrets don't interest me.
Dorian is taken aback by Campbell's contempt, but only momentarily.
They'll have to interest you. You are the one man who is able to save me. You're scientific, Alan. I have seen your name recently in scientific reviews in connection with certain curious experiments.
What has that to do with you?
What you've got to do is to destroy the thing that is upstairs. Destroy it so that not a vestige is left. Nobody saw this person come into the house. He's supposed to be in Paris. When he is missed, not a trace of him must be found here. You must change him and everything that belongs to him, including his coat and his traveling bag, which I have locked up in this room, into a handful of ashes.
You must be insane to suppose I'd lift a finger to help you.
It was suicide, Alan.
What drove him to it?
You won't do this for me.
How can you ask me of all men to mix myself up in this horror?
Alan, it was murder. I killed him. He was responsible for the ruin of my life. He didn't intend it, but the result was the same.
You're certain to be caught. No man commits a crime without doing something stupid. I'll have no part of it.
We were friends once, Alan.
I regret that.
Don't you understand that if you don't help me, I am lost?
They will hang me for what I have done.
Let them.
You refuse?
Yes.
I entreat you.
It's useless.
I'm sorry, Alan. You leave me no alternative. I've written a letter. Here it is.
He places it on the table by the cat.
You see the address. If you don't help me, I must send it. If you don't help me, I will send it. You know what the result will be.
Dismayed, Campbell slumps into a chair and stares at the letter.
The thing is quite simple, Alan.
It would kill her.
I didn't think you would want her name involved in such a scandal.
I cannot do it.
You have no choice.
His head hung in shame, Campbell unclenches his fist.
I shall have to go home and get some things from the laboratory.
Satisfied, Dorian places his hand on Campbell's shoulder.
You saved my life.
Campbell reaches for the letter and crumples it.
Dorian dined that evening with Lady Narborough, who had what Lord Henry described as the remains of a really remarkable ugliness.
You left early last night, Dorian. Did you go straight home or did you go to the club?
Why are you so inquisitive, Harry? I came in at 12:30. If you want any corroborative evidence, you can ask my man.
Well, then, your promise, Lord Henry.
2 hours unaccounted for, Dorian. I suspect we'll bear investigation. Or perhaps they will not.
You've hardly touched my beautiful dinner, Lord Henry. I believe you're in love.
I haven't been in love for a week, not since Madame de Farrell left town.
Madame de Farrell?
She's a wonderful woman, Lady Narborough. When her third husband died, her hair turned quite gold from grief.
What's her fourth husband like?
Husbands of beautiful women belong to the criminal classes.
I'm not surprised that the world says you're extremely wicked.
What world says that, Lady Narborough? It can only be the next world. This world and Harry are on excellent terms.
Everyone I know says he's wicked.
It's monstrous the way people go about nowadays, saying things behind one's back that are absolutely and entirely true. Women love us for our defects. If we have enough of them, they'll forgive us anything, even our intellects.
Very true.
At any rate, no one will ever persuade me that Mr. Gray's wicked, and I shall never forgive him for remaining a bachelor.
Sitting beside David, Gladys gazes across at Dorian.
I shall go through Debrett carefully tonight and draw out a list of all the eligible young ladies.
With their ages?
Only slightly edited. I want it to be a suitable alliance. I want you both to be happy.
I shall save you the trouble of looking, Lady Narborough. I've already chosen her. She will have me.
I don't believe it.
Gladys, darling, will you marry me?
Lady Narborough is happily astonished. Lord Henry and the other guests are stunned. Gladys smiles blissfully.
Of course I will, darling.
The only marriage I've ever approved of.
I'm exciting her terribly.
By Jove, that is a stunner.
I'm so happy for you.
David is crestfallen. At Scotland Yard, Dorian and Gladys are escorted to an office.
For months, the mysterious disappearance of Basil Hallward was the sensation of London.
Inside.
You don't mind if I go on with my work while we talk?
Not at all.
It's a matter of some urgency. Tell me what you discovered in France.
We discovered nothing at all.
We hunted up everyone, even remotely acquainted with my uncle, but not one had seen him or heard from him.
The Paris police don't believe he ever arrived in France.
And here at Scotland Yard, we're equally convinced he did leave London. The man in the grey ulster who boarded the train at Victoria Station was undoubtedly Basil Hallward.
What are we to do now?
You're both young. I understand you're engaged to marry. Go on with your own lives peacefully. Believe me, that's the best course. I promise you Scotland Yard will not forget Basil Hallward.
I thought it might be good for Gladys to go away for a while, out of London.
It would be.
I'm going to my country place at Selby tomorrow. I've persuaded Gladys to join me there with some friends on Thursday.
Good.
The others are coming for the pheasant shooting. We'd be delighted if you'd join us, Sir Robert.
Oh, I'm afraid I can't get away. But I'm glad you're going. The diversion will do you good.
Thank you, Sir Robert. You've been very kind.
Not at all.
As they head for the door, Sir Robert looks at a police report.
Mr. Gray, are you acquainted with a young man named Alan Campbell?
Why, yes. One time we were great friends. It's been a long time since I've seen him. Why do you ask?
I've just received a very tragic notice. This morning, Alan Campbell died by his own hand.
Why on earth should Alan Campbell?
Why, indeed. I thought you might give me a clue. He had everything to live for. He was just beginning to achieve a name for himself in science.
He left no note or letter, no explanation of any sort?
None. Whatever drove him to it, he took the secret with him. How little we really know what goes on inside a man.
Dorian regards him coolly.
Yes.
Outside Gladys's home.
You've been sad all evening. Is it Alan Campbell?
Perhaps.
I'm sorry. Let's be married soon, in a fortnight. A simple wedding with only our closest friends.
A fortnight? You call that soon?
Pleased, Gladys embraces him, pressing her cheek to his. She overlooks his lack of response.
Good night, darling. I'll come to Selby on the Thursday afternoon train with Janet.
I'll be at the station.
Dorian pauses in contemplation before walking back to the waiting cab.
Alan Campbell. Would Alan's blood be on the painting now? There were other roads to forgetfulness than the one that Alan took.
Where to, sir?
Bluegate Fields.
The cab driver swallows his surprise.
Yes, sir.
In Bluegate Fields.
One day we shall be awakened with suffering and dismay to the realization that the soul is not a superstition.
As a preacher addresses a dozen people on a street corner, Dorian alights from his cab nearby.
The eternal words are as true today as when he uttered them. What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? The soul is not an illusion.
Dorian pauses to listen.
It can be bought and sold and bartered away. It can be poisoned or made perfect.
Then he walks off.
That man, rich or poor, was the light of faith and charity within himself, even though he were plunged into the very pit of darkness.
Among the listeners is a seaman.
Still enjoy the clear light of day.
It's Sybil's brother, Jim.
But the wretched creature whose soul is filled with dark thoughts and foul deeds must dwell in darkness, even though he walk under the noonday sun.
Jim strolls off.
He must carry his own vile dungeon round with him.
Jim wanders through the gloomy streets, twisting a cord in his hands. When he notices the distant music, he pauses for a moment. Then he stops dead, remembering where he heard it. Turning in the direction it's coming from, he breaks into a run. The music leads him to the shabby house near the waterfront. He pauses outside it, then heads for the door. Inside, he strides across the room to the piano and stares at the pianist. It's the same old man. He looks up blankly at Jim, who lifts the oil lamp to look at the player. As Jim looks down in disappointment, a young woman strolls over.
What's that you're playing? It has a name, hasn't it?
A kind of name. It's called Prelude.
Jim plunks a coin on the piano.
Play something else.
The young woman takes his arm and guides him over to her table.
Why you do not like that music?
I heard someone play that piece before.
Jim twists the cord in his hands as the barkeep brings a bottle and two shot glasses.
18 years ago.
A woman?
As she pours him a shot, Jim shakes his head.
Every time I get back to London, I look for him. Sir Tristan, my sister called him, because he was like a knight. If he was in Rangoon or Valparaiso, I'd find him. But in London, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I don't know his real name. I don't even know what he looks like.
When you find him, what will you do?
Jim has twisted the cord into a noose. As he tightens it, the door to the stairs opens.
Maybe he's dead already. Did you think of that?
And Dorian steps into the room. Jim tosses back his shot of gin.
I'll keep on looking. You're not English.
What is English? There are men, and there are women.
Dorian pauses by another couple.
This is Sir Tristan Cape, darling.
I've asked you not to call me that, Adrian.
I heard Lord Henry call you Sir Tristan at the time. I thought it fit.
Why do we never see you?
I have all I need here. Drink and drugs and no friends.
He looks up at Dorian.
I've had too many friends.
Oh, he's drawing a picture of you, sir. Come and look at it.
What would you like? A song? Poem? Painting? I do all three surpassingly well.
Adrian has drawn a caricature of Dorian on the table.
Seems to me there's something lacking.
Adrian peers up at Dorian.
I have it. A grim to see.
He adds a gallows and noose to the caricature.
A gallows tree.
Goodbye, Adrian.
Green or dry, a man must die before it bears its fruit. Goodbye, Sir Tristan.
Jim looks up as Dorian leaves. He strides over to Adrian's table.
What did you call him?
Adrian glances up at him.
Sit down. Now draw your picture. The price of three drinks. Four drinks.
Sir Tristan, you said.
And Sir Tristan rode forth into the forest, seeking his only love.
Jim bolts out the door.
He has gone to kill your friend.
Justice has come to England. Without
wig or gown. Come on, Kate.
The two women follow him out. Meanwhile...
If it's money you want.
I'm Sybil Vane's brother. Does that mean anything to you?
No, nothing.
Why are you called Sir Tristan?
Happens to be my name.
You're lying. 18 years I've been looking for you.
How old do you think I am?
With the cord around Dorian's neck, Jim drags him into the light of a street lamp. Jim studies his youthful, unlined face. Dorian looks back at him calmly. Deflated, Jim pulls the cord from Dorian's neck and lets him go. Adrian and the two women watch Jim trudge toward them.
Why didn't you murder him? They could only have hanged you for it.
He's not the man I'm looking for. He's too young.
How old do you think he is?
22, I'd say. What are you laughing at?
Dorian Gray has looked 22 for the last 20 years.
Jim stares at him.
What did you say his name was?
With his chalk, Adrian writes on a wall. Dorian Gray of Mayfair and Selby. He smiles drunkenly at Jim. The next day on a train, Jim sits stone-faced in a third-class coach. Meanwhile, in first class...
When a man says he's exhausted life, you may be sure that life has exhausted him. But in your case, the strange impulse to be good is merely the effect of your approaching marriage. It'll wear off in time. Do you mind pulling down that blind, Dorian?
Not at all. The truth is, I want to be better. I'm determined to be better.
But at least it can be a novel sensation and even become a habit.
Marriage itself is merely a habit. A very bad habit.
I trust it will make you a hopelessly reformed character.
Harry? I've been away so long. What are people talking about in London?
We were talking about Basil's disappearance, but now they're completely taken up with Alan Campbell's suicide.
What do you think has happened to Basil?
I haven't the slightest idea. I suppose in a fortnight or so we shall be told that he's been seen in San Francisco. It's an odd thing, but everyone who disappears is said to be seen in San Francisco. It must be a delightful city and possess all the attractions of the next world.
He's a fine painter, I'm certain of that.
You know, the best thing that Basil ever did was that wonderful portrait of you. I remember you told me it was stolen or destroyed or something. What is your secret, Dorian? You don't look a day older than you did when that portrait was painted.
Perhaps I'll tell you someday.
To get back my youth, I'd do anything in the world except get up early, take exercise, or be respectable.
Dorian sighs.
I sometimes think I'd give anything if I could change and grow old like other people.
The train arrives at Selby. A waiting servant opens the door of the first-class coach for Lord Henry and Dorian. Glancing down the platform, Dorian sees Jim. And Jim sees Dorian.
My good resolutions may have come too late.
That night...
Though Dorian placed guards about the estate, the consciousness of being hunted, snared, tracked down, began to dominate him.
Dorian lies in bed.
In the small hours of the night, when every sound is seized upon by the distraught imagination, remorse and terror laid hold of him. Each detail of his crimes came back to him in nightmares with added horror, haunting him relentlessly with the living death of his soul. With the day came the cruel necessity to dissemble to Gladys and to his guests.
Dorian joins his guests out in the fields.
Have you had good sport, Geoffrey?
Not very good, Dorian. I think most of the birds have gone to the open. It may be better after lunch when we get a new growl.
They spot a rabbit. Geoffrey raises his gun.
Don't shoot it, Geoffrey.
Nonsense!
He aims as the hare bolts into a thicket.
Good heavens, I've hit a beater. What an idiot the man wants to get in front of the gun. Stop shooting there, a man's hurt.
Where, sir? Where is he?
Here. Why on earth don't you keep your men back? Spoiled by shooting for the day.
Men hurry past Dorian toward the thicket. As Dorian looks on expressionlessly, Lord Henry leaves the knot of men and comes over to him.
I've told him the shooting stopped for today. It wouldn't look well to go on.
Is the man?
Yes, he's dead. He received a full charge in his chest.
Later, back at the house...
Thornton, come in. I suppose you've come about the unfortunate accident this morning. Was he married? Did he have any people dependent upon him? I'll write them any sum you think necessary.
We don't know who he is. That's why I took the liberty of coming to you.
Wasn't he one of your men?
No, sir. Never saw him before. Seems like a sailor.
Sailor?
Looks as if he'd been a sort of sailor, tattooed on both arms and that kind of thing.
Wasn't anything found on him? Anything that would tell his name?
Some money. Not much. And a six-shooter. No name of any kind. Decent-looking man, sir, but rough-like. Sort of sailor, we think.
Where is the body?
In an empty stable at the home farm.
They hurry out. In the stable, several gamekeepers watch over the body. Dorian stops a few paces from it.
Show me his face.
One of the men steps forward and removes the handkerchief that covers the dead man's face. It's Sybil's brother, Jim. Dorian recognizes him and turns away.
Come in.
Dorian enters Gladys's room.
What is it, Dorian? Oh, but you haven't changed. You'll be late for dinner.
He steps over to her.
I wanted to look at you.
I know, darling. I felt that way so often about you.
Dorian kisses her cheek.
Goodbye. Until 8:30.
Until 8:30.
He turns and goes out, leaving Gladys concerned. Dorian rides alone in a carriage. When it slows, he glances out the window. From a carriage headed the other way on the narrow road, David peers out at Dorian. David watches him pass.
Shall I go on, sir?
Yes.
Back at the house...
Dorian! Dorian!
Gladys lets herself into Dorian's sitting room. She's confused and concerned to find it empty. David enters with Lord Henry.
David, what brings you to Selby? Have you seen Dorian? What is it? What's happened?
Dorian's gone to London, didn't you know? David passed him on his way from the station. It's strange he's rushing away like that.
Black as thunder. I thought perhaps he'd found out what I'd been up to.
What have you been up to, David?
You'll put it down to jealousy. I don't deny the jealousy's mixed up in it. But I had a dreadful presentiment about you and Dorian. And when you announced the date of marriage, I grew desperate. I wanted to do anything to try and stop it.
What is it you've done, David?
There's a locked room at the top of Dorian's house. I didn't attach any importance to it at first. He could have locked up anything there that he wanted to keep safe from the servants, even. But then one of Dorian's valets came to see me about a position. It struck me how often Dorian changed his servants. This one told me that Dorian would seal up that room at all hours and lock himself in. One night he heard a noise and went to investigate. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Dorian came out of the room and looked at him in the strangest way, as if he could kill him, he said. Then he accused him of spying and sacked him. I began to feel that if I could get into that room, I might find something that would put a stop to this marriage.
And did you get in?
Unable to look Gladys in the face, David turns away.
I bribed one of the servants to get an impression of the lock. Here's the key. I waited until Dorian came down here to Selby, and then I let myself in. I know you'll despise me for stooping to such measures, but I'm not important. It doesn't matter what happens to me or even what you think of me. If I can stop you from marrying him.
What did you find in the room?
Nothing to help me, really. It's just an old schoolroom with books and things, and there's a huge portrait with a covering over it.
Portrait of whom?
I don't know. The original must be a monstrous person if an original exists. It has a vague family resemblance to Dorian, a sort of middle-aged, mad, gruesome uncle with a debauched face and blood all over him. It was painted by your uncle.
My uncle never painted such a picture.
He signed it. I'd been counting so much on finding something to help me that I decided perhaps it was just stupid jealousy on my part that I'd been doing Dorian a great injustice. I had an impulse to come down here and make a clean breast of it to both of you. Give you my blessing and ask your forgiveness.
Can you describe the portrait in greater detail?
There's a curious cat in it, like the one in Dorian's drawing room. Only in the portrait, the eyes shine in an evil way that's indescribable.
Gladys is troubled.
Did you notice anything unusual about the signature?
No, I don't think so. Now that I see you, Gladys, I can't say what I intended to. I'd be lying if I did. I know that this marriage is wrong. You mustn't go through with it. There's something strange and evil in Dorian.
Was there a letter G under the signature on that painting, David? Like this?
I believe there was. How did you know?
The coachman stands in the doorway.
Yes, Gibson.
I beg your pardon, miss. Mr. Gray asked me to bring you this letter when I got back from the station. He said I must give it to you in person.
Thank you.
With David and Lord Henry watching, Gladys opens the sealed envelope and begins to read.
Once I said that if I were to marry you, it would be an incredible wickedness. You thought it was a way of saying that I didn't love you. You must know that I do love you, more than anything in the world. But I can only bring disaster on those who love me. If you knew how I've already wronged you, you would turn from me in horror. You will never see me again. Try to remember me, dear Gladys, without bitterness. This is the only good thing I have ever done.
Won't you tell us what it is, Gladys? Perhaps we can help you.
Lost in thought, she hands the letter to Lord Henry.
We must go to London at once.
In London, Dorian unlocks the door of the schoolroom and steps inside.
Was it true that one could never change? He longed for the unstained purity of his youth before he had prayed in a monstrous moment of pride and passion that the painting should bear the burden of the years and of his corruption.
He lights the hanging lamp.
Sybil Vane was dead. Now her brother would be hidden in a nameless grave. Alan Campbell had shot himself. from Basil.
Closing the door,
nothing could alter that.
He locks it from the inside.
It was of the future that he must think. He had spared Gladys. Would there be any sign of his one good deed in the portrait?
Hesitantly, Dorian steps over to the painting. Averting his eyes, he pulls the coverlet off. Then, fearful of what he'll find, he turns away. Finally, he forces himself to look at the portrait.
It was there. Almost imperceptible, but surely it was there in the eyes, struggling through the horror and the loathsomeness. There was hope for him then. He would go away, leave England forever, live obscurely in a distant country, find peace in a life of humility and self-denial. He would expel every sign of evil from the painted face. He would watch the hideousness fade and change. But the painting would always be there to tempt his weakness. Better to destroy it, to grow old inevitably as all men grow old. If he fell into evil ways, to be punished as all men are punished. Better if each sin of his life were to bring it sure, swift penalty. The knife that had killed Basil Hallward would kill his portrait also, and free him at a stroke from the evil enchantment of the past.
He picks up the knife. And then turns to the portrait. Hatred for the disgusting image swells up in him. Lunging forward, he stabs the knife into it.
But when the knife pierced the heart of the portrait, an extraordinary thing happened.
Clutching his chest, Dorian staggers back. He slumps across the table, banging into the lamp, and then collapses to the floor. The lamp swings back and forth in front of the portrait with the knife sticking in its heart. The image on the canvas begins to blur and swirl in fog.
Pray, Father, forgive me. Pray, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. Pray, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. Through my fault, through my most grievous fault.
And gradually, the original image of Dorian begins to appear. The image of a handsome youth, fresh, pure, and without blemish. The locked door is forced open and David bursts in, followed by Lord Henry. They look from the body crumpled on the floor to the painting. The body on the floor, meanwhile, has become a diseased and hideous monstrosity of a man.
Heaven forgive me.
As Gladys enters, David tries to stop her, but she steps past him. She looks at the body with sadness and pity, and then turns away in tears.
Take Gladys home, David.
David slips an arm around her and leads her out. The Egyptian cat statue sits on the drawing room table. Leaning against it is an open book of poetry, The Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam. I sent my soul through the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell, and by my soul returned to me and answered, I myself am heaven and hell. The end.
This described version of The Picture of Dorian Gray was created by Audio Vision Canada. For other described movies and audio cinema titles available from Audio Vision Canada, call toll-free 1-800-567-6755.
The cast: Lord Henry Wotton, George Sanders, Dorian Gray, Herd Hatfield, Gladys Hallward, Donna Reed, Sybil Vane, Angela Lansbury, David Stone, Peter Lawford, Basil Hallward, Noel Gilmore, Jim Vane, Richard Fraser, Alan Campbell, Douglas Walton, Adrian Singleton, Morton Lowry, Sir Robert Bentley, Miles Mander, Mrs. Vane, Lydia Bilbrook, Lady Agatha, Mary Forbes, Sir Thomas, Robert Grieg, Duchess, Moina McGill, Malvolio Jones Chairman, Billy Bevan, Young Frenchwoman, Rennie Carson, Kate, Lillian Bond.